Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, so our panel today, Scott Lucas is Professor of US and International Relations at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Lorna Fitzpatrick is a communications consultant. Mary Hanafin is a barrister and a former Fianna Fáil Minister for Education. And Oisín Coughlan is a public policy advisor. Good morning, everyone.
Morning,
Brendan.
So Mary Hanafin, bar maybe a kind of a half-hearted attempt by Colm Eastwood and, of course, Conor McGregor, you are the first woman anyway to publicly admit that, yes, you would like to run for president.
It's about giving a straight answer to a straight question, which a lot of politicians don't. Yes, I'd love the opportunity. I'd love the opportunity to be a Fianna Fáil candidate, and I'd love to bring my experience in public service and law onto the job of president, which is the most important job in the country. And I'm sorry to see so many people ruling themselves out. I think the public at this stage know who doesn't want to run, but they don't know who does want to run. And I think maybe the time is now to start that.
Okay, why do you think you should be president?
That's the question for the campaign, but I would like to bring 30 years of public service at local and national level to the job, where I've worked very closely with individuals and with communities. I believe it's, in the first instance, a constitutional role. It's set out in the Constitution. You take an oath to the service and the welfare of people, which I would like to bring.
Are you suggesting implicitly there that you would be narrowing back down the role of the president?
I'm not, but I would say that I understand the role, the constitutional role of it. And every president has kind of pushed out the boundaries in a really positive way. Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese, Michael D. Higgins. But that shouldn't be the starting point for each president. You can bring it back and then push out your own boundaries. But it has to be within the Constitution. And I also have a very strong belief and faith in the welfare of the people of this country and the communities around the country, which I've worked with over the years, and would like to be able to continue that.
OK. Are you concerned? A lot of people who are not going for this, you do get a suggestion that it is the viciousness of recent campaigns is an issue. Are you concerned about putting yourself into that kind of a dogfight where they play the man, woman, not the ball?
The campaigns have been absolutely vicious, you're right. Probably because you have five candidates instead of 500. You have individuals.
And because there are no real
issues. You have individuals rather than policies.
Gaza will probably be a huge issue this time, but there aren't issues as such. It is about
there aren't issues. I think, because I've been in the public life for so long, people know who I am and what I stand for and everything about me. Everything about you is public.
When you're been happy in public life. Nothing would be dragged up or anything. It's all out there already.
I think everything about
all your mistakes are well known.
All my mistakes are well known, well documented. And I genuinely would love that opportunity.
You've had a conversation with Micheál Martin?
I've had a good conversation with Micheál Martin. Absolutely no commitments, no nothing from him.
Was he encouraging?
He listened, as he does. Now, he knows me as well, remember. You know, we sat at the cabinet table together. He knows me well. He knows my interests. He knows my record in government. I mean, he would be the first to say, look, could you introduce the DESH scheme for schools for disadvantaged? You know, I mean, there's a record there that he is well aware of. What his thinking is in relation to the election, I think there's two things. One, is Fianna Fáil going to run a candidate?
Yeah. What impression did you get about that?
Well, whatever about what he wants to do, what I would like to see is Fianna Fáil contesting it because we are the largest
vibes?
Party.
It's all about the vibes these days. You must have picked up a vibe off him. Like, does he seem like someone who's chomping at the bit to run a candidate for Fianna Fáil?
I think he accepts that Fianna Fáil is the largest party in local government. We're the largest party in national government. And the right thing to do is to contest it. But at the same time, he wants to make sure that he has a candidate who does well. I mean, Fine Gael were very badly scalded back in 2011 with a good man in Gay Mitchell, but it just didn't connect with the electorate. So I've no doubt that Micheál Martin wants to find the right candidate. And I've always said that the Irish people have a fabulous ability to elect the right person as president in each and every election. No matter what. No, I mean that.
Yeah, yeah. No, if you say so yourself, okay.
No, but I do.
Listen,
I mean,
tell me this.
Mary McAleese wasn't the front runner. Michael D. Higgins wasn't the front runner. Okay. Mary Robinson wasn't the front runner. But the Irish people tend to go behind what they initially see and to work out who's the best person for the next 7 years.
And you clearly feel that if they, when they do that and they look into their hearts, you think there's a good chance that they would see that you are the one.
I would be willing to put myself before people. I wouldn't be as confident or as cocky enough to be able to say, no, people are going to select me.
Is it kind of, you see, I think a lot of the time I think, is it kind of cocky in the first place to think I should be the president? I should be the first citizen? Like, you wouldn't be lacking confidence to say, I think, yes, I should represent the whole country.
The very first day, Brendan, that you put your name on a ballot paper and you put yourself on a poster and everywhere you drive around, you said, there's me looking down at me. I mean, that takes guts and it takes confidence, of course, to do it for president is a lot bigger than that. But I have to say, I mean, there was a lot of coverage in The Independent yesterday, which I was not expecting. I don't think I merited front page news. When Conor Feehan was doing the article, he had asked me to do one on kind of resilience. And how he saw me in court one day in Monaghan, and he said, oh, there's Mary Hannafin dressed like a barrister. And he said, well, there's somebody who doesn't just sit back, you know, has constantly moved on, constantly changed, and asked, could he do an article on it? And at the very end of it, he asked me about the presidency.
Had you thought about it, though?
I had spoken to me on Martin.
Oh, yeah,
at that
of course,
stage.
Yeah.
But I thought that that was going to be an add-on to that article that he wrote yesterday about my personal life and about resilience.
I think you're very naive. No, somebody actually announcing for president, you thought
to be
the last line in the piece.
I genuinely didn't think it would be the front page.
Okay, one other question for you.
But as a neighbour said to me last night, he said, people want to know you want this job.
Hmm. Yeah.
I thought that was a really fair comment.
Yeah. And so you're not doing this thing of that, like, have people come to you? You know, most people say, well, yes, a lot of people have suggested to me I should put myself forward. I had barely thought of it, but if people are saying it, I should listen. You decided this yourself.
I suppose I did, because I was looking at the number of people who were saying no, people with very good track records, people who've given a lot to this country saying, no, I wouldn't do it and I wouldn't face it. And I mean, I am 100% committed to public service. I mean, that's what I have done at every level.
Okay, one other question for you. Do you think you are going to face a competition or some kind of we know now that Fine Gael have their process laid out and everything. Do you think you could face a process within Fianna Fáil, you know, a competition?
It hasn't been outlined at all yet. Now, I see in the paper today that Peter Power is mentioned, so we could well have a nomination process, but nothing has been said yet.
Okay.
So I think ultimately the decision would be Micheál Martin's.
Oisín Coughlan, you want to come in there?
Well, one of you said that it's that people don't seem to want the job, but I actually think that the truth is more what you said. The job they would like, it's the campaign they don't want. So if you could put your name into a hat based on being nominated and it was random, more people would go forward. But the campaigns have been brutal. And there's also the calculation with political parties. I mean, Mary said it's the most important job in the country. I don't think political parties think it is. They think the Taoiseach is the most important job and political power in the Dáil is most important. But they know they can't ignore, or they have to decide, can they ignore it? The thing that was most striking in the coverage today was, I mean, I knew this, but Fianna Fáil haven't put forward a candidate for election since 1997.
That's right.
Because Mary McAleese was just renominated and they didn't put someone forward in 2011-2018. That, for the party that had the presidency since the foundation of the state, or the 1937 constitution, to 1990, not to have put forward a candidate for almost 30 years now is kind of extraordinary when you think about it. So I think they're going to have to, and there is coverage. John Lee has an article in the Mail as well as the Peter Power article in the Sunday Indo. That, like, what will Fianna Fáil do? And I think they will have to put forward somebody. They're not likely to give Fine Gael a free run. Mairead McGuinness seems the likely candidate, although she may have to win against Sean Kelly in a primary. So I think there will be a Fianna Fáil candidate, and why not put yourself forward?
Yeah, okay. Lorna, you were looking at a piece in the Mail on Sunday by John Drennan. Is it time to say vote for Joe?
Yeah.
Did we see the beginnings of a presidential campaign on Friday, do you think, as suggested, I think, in a piece in the Sunday Times?
Yeah, who knows? The piece itself says that the Labour Party is...
Joe Duffy, by the way.
One name, exactly.
Beyonce.
It does... say that the Labour Party is speaking or has spoke to Joe Duffy, I think is the way in which it was worded. As a member of the Labour Party, I can tell you I have no insider knowledge to bring to the conversation. But I do think that it will be, Joe is a well-known, well-respected individual across the country, has such kindness and compassion, I think, that people have seen over the years. And speaking to Oisín's point around the campaign, and I think, yes, the toxicity of the campaign for election is one of the big challenges.
Is there any way of us all agreeing in some way not to do that, or would that fall apart?
Well, maybe by starting very late. If it doesn't start until the end of September, there's less time.
I think the timing on this one is probably influential in that, and parties choosing not to put somebody forward so early to allow that summer period, where it's a silly season. Let's be honest, when it comes to media, and you know anything can go in. If you have candidates announced and very clear, then maybe that's where they will target.
Keep it tight.
I don't know whether Joe would have that same level of vitriol that some candidates do have when it comes to the campaign. So that might be a changing point.
Yeah, but you don't know until you know, do you? Scott, you have the benefit of being an outsider. This the kind of Irish presidential thing it's a queer beast, really, isn't it? It's a unique kind of thing in a way, isn't it? That we're a republic there with a government and everything else. I know other countries have presidents and prime ministers, but the relationships tend to be different and the role of the president is different. We have this kind of quasi person who does the kind of stuff that maybe the royal family would do in the UK or something, and then has a constitutional role as well. Do you find it odd?
I find it part of the learning process. I had a friend asked me this week. He said, well, it's just symbolic. Isn't it just a symbolic post? I said, well, yeah. But it's pretty powerful symbolism. I mean, it's pretty powerful symbolism in terms of, and Oisín sort of referred to this, you know, the foundation of the Irish state going back to the 1920s and how the office then evolves from that. But if you think about it, 1990s, Mary Robinson, as Ireland is not only trying to be the new Ireland, but as it's sort of projecting itself to the world, think about what she did there. Think about Mary McAleese at that time of the Good Friday Agreement, not just representing it, but actually some very important behind-the-scenes work on Good Friday that was essential. And then you think about Michael D. Higgins, the current president. Now, my wife will say, bless her, she's very English, she'll say, he's the one with the dog, right? And I say, yeah, he's the one with the dog. But it's almost also that Michael D., as we come out of the great financial crash, as Ireland again is trying to remake itself as this vibrant country, a changing country in so many respects.
Yeah.
And he goes out and represents that. And the very fact...
This is an interesting point that Scott is making, that in the era of, I was referencing vibes earlier, in the era of vibes, and actually in an era of like where symbolism is almost as important as facts and everything, is the person, if the government is the head... Mm-hmm. Is the person who represents the heart of the country actually an incredibly powerful role? But then we treat picking it as a kind of a blood sport.
It is an extremely important role, and I think most people would agree with that. And I think Scott's points are absolutely will resonate with people right across the country in terms of it is very powerful symbolism. And I do think the majority of people will agree with that. I don't think the majority of people like the way in which the presidential campaign takes place. I really don't. And if back to your earlier point, if we all agreed not to do that, I do think we would all be the better of it. And we would be able to have much more, I suppose, respectful conversations around the future direction of the presidency and where we want to take that role. And as Mary said, bringing it back to the constitutional role and building it out in your own way, I think that's a really fantastic piece to look at.
The 1990 and 1997 campaigns, they were tough campaigns, and I know some of A.D. Roach had a tough time, but I don't think they were as toxic as 2011 or even 2018. So again, it's the social, it's the post-austerity, not post-COVID yet, but social media environment that seems to make it more toxic.
Oh my God, we haven't had a post-COVID presidential election yet. So like that's post-crash, post-social squared, Okay, we'll move on to international matters. So Oisín, would you kick us off with the, there's a piece in the Sunday Independent, scores killed in Gaza airstrikes as US says ceasefire inching closer.
Yeah, I just think this is important to not lose sight of. I mean, I don't think Irish people are, but because of so much else going on, for example, you know, the Israeli attack in Iran and then the US attack in Iran, that there is that, that now it's a bit like the you know, that now that that's calm down again for now.
Yeah, I think the lens is back.
The lens is focusing back. And there was there's a figure in this article that 500 Palestinians have been killed approaching or queuing at the supposed aid distribution sites managed by this US-Israeli Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
There have in fact been claims from IDF soldiers, which I think the IDF say they're looking into it, that they were told to open fire on unarmed citizens.
Yes, they're not allowing, I mean, they don't allow journalists in, foreign journalists. They're not allowing aid in. I mean, this isn't like, it's not some sort of passive reality that other aid isn't entering. The Israeli government is refusing to allow any other aid into Gaza through the UN or anyone else. No foreign journalists. And so they've contrived this supposed humanitarian foundation with the US. And then they're shooting at people who come there desperate for aid. So it is, you could not invent a more grotesque humanitarian or indeed criminal situation, international law situation. And so it's good that the focus is, well, there's not a huge amount of coverage today, but it's good that it might return to it. And Trump is claiming that the ceasefire is a week or so away. And these days, you never know what Trump may be able to pull out of the hat. So, yeah. God, we may be in a situation of hoping he
Is that a grudging admission that Trump actually might be able to do the right thing?
Well, we've known the US, well, to a significant degree, the US are the only country that can tell Israel what to do. Biden wasn't up for it. Trump hasn't been up for it. And to be honest, Netanyahu now seems, despite the fact we're all talking about Trump, Netanyahu's the one who basically called Trump's bluff, attacked Iran anyway. And I think we'll hear what Scott has to say. I think to a large degree, the US attacked Iran because Trump didn't like being upstaged. He wanted to be the centre of attention again. And then he told them to stop and kind of got them to stop. So, you know, can he make Netanyahu have a ceasefire? It may depend on the terms, because for Netanyahu, that means to a significant degree, the collapse of his government. And that means exposure to all the domestic
implications. Yeah, but then various suggestions that he might want an election. Scott, I saw Gershon Baskin, who does seem to be, he's an Israeli negotiator himself, and he seems to be talking to a lot of the negotiating parties at the moment. He's a fairly credible voice. I saw him say two very simple things last night. One is they said to him, can this stop? And he said, yes, it can stop. If Trump tells Netanyahu right now, stop this, the same as he did with Iran, Netanyahu will stop. The second thing he said he can see how it happens, because he said Hamas will not surrender to Israel, but what they would do is surrender to other Palestinians, in some way surrender to like the Palestinian Authority or something, or step down.
First of all, the possibility, and this is how incredible 21st century politics is that Donald Trump, in his social media messaging, as we speak right now, is effectively threatening the Israeli system. And they're threatening the Israeli system by saying, you drop the bribery charges that Benjamin Netanyahu is facing, these serious charges, and then he'll agree to the ceasefire. That's Trump's play here. Now, first of all, beyond the obvious questions about a U.S. president telling the Israeli system what it should do with its legal process, you have that question as to whether Netanyahu would agree to that, because for Netanyahu, this attack on Gaza, as it threatens the existence of Gazans, is very much existential. It's existential because he has vowed to destroy Hamas and to get the hostages, all hostages, back. If he doesn't do that, he faces early elections, and he faces that trial. Now, it may be that if the U.S. threatens to cut military aid and other assistance, then Netanyahu has no choice. But I think right now what we have to say is that Israel's current plan, and we need to remember this, is even if you have a ceasefire, it is for the long-term occupation of Gaza with four military zones and cramming the Palestinians into three areas in between those zones. So you have the dangerous combination of Palestinians who effectively are being allowed to live at a bare minimum, but Hamas is still there in the country. They haven't been expelled. So that's not a recipe for stability.
Okay. I know the next day is important, but I think at the same time, you know, when there's a fire alarm screaming, you're not necessarily thinking about, you know, people aren't going to get a great night's sleep. Right now, to just get this to stop, which apparently an increasing number of Israelis, and I saw the ex-head of the Mossad the other night saying that he needs to stop, needs to stop. Can you see a situation whereby, and the Qataris seem to be also saying a deal could be done in the next week. Can you see a situation whereby this stops in the short term?
Look, I don't want to be negative, but if I had a euro for every time someone had said in the past 20 months, we've got a ceasefire, which is imminent. Mm. With respect, I wouldn't be here with you. I'd be off somewhere in the Caribbean. The question here is everybody's talking up the possibility that something could happen because they really want it to happen. But we've got two fundamental problems. First of all, you're depending on the whims right now of a U.S. president and of an Israeli leader who you would have to almost back into a corner. Secondly, as I think you alluded to, you need to talk about the arrangements where you get Palestinians in a place beyond being allowed to survive. And the problem with just simply saying the Palestinian Authority could come in is the Palestinian Authority is not respected by many Palestinians. It is, and I'm going to carefully choose the phrase here, economically challenged in the way that it has run the West Bank. The real issue here is there needs to be buy-in not just by the United States, but by the Europeans, the international community, and especially the Gulf states, to actually work with Palestinians who are not tied to the past of the Palestinian Authority, with Palestinians who are involved in civic society, and for the Israelis to allow that to happen.
And there seems to be, there's certainly a huge willingness on the Gulf neighbours to come together here and provide some form of governance and security in whatever the next stage of Gaza / Palestine would be, isn't there?
No, I think the problem here is that there's a huge buy-in from Gulf states that if someone else provided for the governance and security, they would put a lot of money into Gaza to rebuild it. But they're not going to take the lead in terms of the government and the security aspects.
Trump sees himself on a peacemaking role at the moment. He's claiming credit.
Africa now, right?
India, and Pakistan, and they had their recent to-do. And now, yes, DRC. And he has his eye. We know he's jealous of Obama for having got a Nobel Peace Prize. So I could see him doing it this week or next week as opposed to 3 weeks or 2 months' time because he wants to just keep going. It's like, what will I do this week?
He feels he's on a roll. Yeah.
But you see, the humanitarian crisis has got just so bad now that I think even he has to listen. You have the World Health talking about the health system.
Should they've left the World Health Organization? I don't think that weighs on his mind.
No, but at least, a health system that's completely dismantled. People who are dying just queuing for food, children who are not only starving, but are dying of thirst, of thirst in this day and age. So, a ceasefire, even without the long-term plan yet, would at least allow humanitarian aid to get in. And that has to be the first thing.
In a meaningful way.
Not in this new
arrangement that has humanitarian in its title, but in anything else, you couldn't view it as being humanitarian in any other way. And I think that is, there does feel as if there is a bit of a change afoot, though. And that is something that maybe Scott is right, though. Maybe we're all just too hopeful for it. And so we're willing it rather than it being the reality. And I'm not sure. I think that has a ring to it, to be honest. Back to the structures in terms of the future piece. And like, I don't know, it was 2018, I think, when I went to Palestine and met with Palestinians who were student organisers, and we were trying to support them in building their structures for being able to represent young people in a meaningful way. And we went alongside colleagues from Northern Ireland and from the UK, and it was in a post-conflict kind of piece that we were there.
Where were you?
We were in Ramallah, so not on the Gaza Strip, but we spent 4 days in Ramallah meeting with the student leaders within Palestine.
Okay, what was your big takeaway?
That they wanted to create structures that were outside of politics to be able to represent the young people and the voices and the experiences on a broader scale, and that they weren't getting that opportunity. They didn't have the platform to be able to provide their experiences or share their experiences outside of the small groups in which they were in, because their focus was on trying to get water, on trying to make sure that they had food. You know, it was on those primary, like you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know.
That's what I was thinking, and that was very much
where it was. But I do think that, like, that was back in 2018. There was a drive and a want to, and like that was a small scale, we're talking student representation, you know, but there was a drive and a want to be able to have an alternative approach to representing those voices. And so I do think there is the opportunity to build that further.
So it's really interesting what Laura is saying, because I did some work with Palestinian women through the OECD on their governance programme. And number of years working with them voluntarily. And again, exactly as Orna is saying, with the young students, the women, they want to be involved. They wanted to be trained for participation in their future, in governance, in government, in local authorities, whatever they could do. But the immediate problems are so great that they can't look to a situation beyond that.
They haven't time to think about the kind of cultural battles that we've had here. Yeah.
No.
Scott, I don't want to take the lens away from Gaza, but Iran is important in this whole picture, and Iran is interesting at the moment. So, look, I'll ask you a convoluted question now, because I probably went down a rabbit hole on this myself during the week. But is there a situation in which if the Supreme Leader dies, does it seem as if, say, for example, guys who are in the Revolutionary Guard, who run much more than, they're much more than military organisation, they're political, they're economic, they're everything else, they're very powerful. They are not as a hardline Muslim in any way than him. Is there a way in which, I saw someone say, regimes don't always fall, often regimes just change themselves. Is there a moment here where Iran could change itself?
We're in a dangerous point where there's many possibilities in Iran, because if you were to remove the Supreme Leader, and the Israelis,
but he will be removed at some point, in the sense of, you know, Allah's going to remove him because he's 86 and he is increasingly frail.
He's 86. The Israelis were trying to assassinate him during the 12-day war. He has made plans for his successor, and he communicated them during the war, which takes place. So there is a scenario in which he just simply hands power to someone he taps to succeed him, including possibly his son, Mushtaba.
His son, who is apparently a much more moderate individual, though.
His son is much more of, let's use that phrase applied to Trump, a transactional individual. He's made quite a nice little living for himself, let's put it that way. He's established various connections so he could set him up to become Supreme Leader. But you cannot say he'll be more moderate in his approach that takes place.
I heard a guy from Iran last night, it's kind of apropos of nothing, but it was really interesting, saying that basically the death to America kind of contingent, if you want to call them that, is 10 to 15% of the population of Iran. He said, like, even the regime themselves send their children abroad to be educated. Their children are interested in things like, the new generation are interested in K-pop. They're interested, they're tweeting about Justin Bieber and concerns about his health and all this kind of stuff. What he said was that there was a project here to make this perfect Muslim country. That was the revolutionary project. We will make a country and see can it be run on model Muslim lines. He said that has completely failed and that country does not actually exist.
Let me cut to the chase, because there's a lot of dangerous words around, like regime change, that are thrown out. When I was able to work and talk to people in Iran before 2009, when it was too dangerous for me to go back, as well as dangerous for a lot of the people with who are my friends.
Yeah.
They talked about the gradual revolution.
Yeah.
And the gradual revolution is that the revolution of 1979, the Islamic revolution, which was a wide variety of groups, it wasn't just clerics, had values in terms of being a better country, in terms not only of your faith, but in terms of respect for everyone, in terms of dialogue, including women, including young people, and that the revolution had been betrayed by the leadership over the course of the next 30 years as it then was. We're now talking about 45. So they wanted reform. They wanted this space for rights. They wanted this political participation that was cruelly denied to them in 2009 with the rigged presidential election. So forever since then, with the man who probably won that election in 2009 being under house arrest since 2011, Mir Hossein Mousavi, they've been trying to get that. But here's the problem. There are people in the Iranian diaspora. There have been governments, including in the U.S. government and the Israelis, who say, we will change your regime for you. We will get rid of them. And with respect, almost every Iranian friend, every Iranian contact I say is, you cannot do that.
Okay, but can the regime evolve? And I mean, we've talked a lot about Iraq recently and regime change. And a lot of people would say the big mistake there was that de-bathification thing where anyone who had anything to do with the old regime had to be gone and you're left with a country with no scaffolding, no civil service, no nothing left in it. Do we have to go, okay, maybe this regime evolves to something more acceptable and that we have to make friends with it?
In the short term, no. Because if you take it beyond the Supreme Leader to the Revolutionary Guards, who actually are more hardline than the Supreme Leader in some respects, they have been reinforced in trying to hang on to power because of this war. And more importantly, many Iranians who would like to see them changed are in a position where they have to rally around them for the sake of the nation. Yesterday, when some of those Revolutionary Guards who were killed were buried, political figures were buried, some of whom were very much disliked by many of my friends in Iran, hundreds of thousands of Iranians still took the street in Tehran because it wasn't an attack on their leaders. It was an attack on their country.
Okay. And look, sorry, we went down a bit of a rabbit hole there, but it is really interesting and you do know a lot about it. So I think that's definitely one to watch. Okay, we'll take a break. Scott Lucas, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hanafin and Oisin Coughlin staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Scott Lucas, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hanafin and Oisin Coughlin. So, Lorna, there's a poll in the Business Post, and I read that headline earlier, stark political divide between homeowners and renters emerges.
Yeah.
What's the stark political divide?
So I don't know if it's news that it emerges. I would have thought that was, you know, but nonetheless, I think this is a poll in the Business Post, which showed that 43% of homeowners would vote for either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael in the next election. That's compared to 25% of those who don't own their own home. I don't think that's unusual. I think that would have been somewhat expected in terms of figures.
I'll just give, if you don't mind, the Red Sea interviewed a random sample of 1,008 adults aged 18 plus online between the 20th and 25th of June, and the margin of error is plus or minus 3% on that.
Thanks, okay. Brendan. I suppose the piece that really jumped out at me from the poll was that renters were more undecided about who to vote for, and 72% were undecided, and that kind of gave a growing sense of disillusionment maybe in terms of politics and what can be done to address the housing challenge.
Is it Richard Caldwell writing about it says that the next election, the government, the current government, could be facing a demographic time bomb.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that piece around home ownership doesn't directly relate to age and, you know, generation, but there is quite a large amount of that. You know, it's not a direct correlation, but it is very similar. So I do think that is a major issue for young people. But like the 72% not knowing where they would place their vote shows me that there's a significant issue there for political parties, because everybody is saying that we can do this to fix the problem. We can do this to fix the problem. But what this is telling us is that people don't believe it, or, you know, don't actually see how we get from where we are now.
You see political parties, you'll see it as well. It's all to play for there.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, what that tells me is that we really need to bring it down into actual realities as to what this will do and how it will impact you.
Because at the moment, you won't mind me asking, because you've talked about it here before. Yeah. You're still a renter, are you? And still trying to buy a home?
We're in the fun process, and I say fun very lightheartedly, in terms of trying to secure a suitable long-term future in terms of housing. And we're in the process of trying to maybe finish building a house that was left derelict by a builder during the recession. He went bust.
This is the kind of thing we want people to be doing. I presume you're getting grants and encouragement, are you?
We are getting every brick wall that you could possibly find, and we're hitting it.
Really?
And we're trying to get through them, but we're...
So that process is not as frictionless as it should be to encourage people to do that,
not.
In your experience.
And nobody is disagreeing with us doing it. You know, everybody in the area agrees with the idea of us finishing this property. There's nobody, you know, it's not as if there's somebody down the road who's complaining or putting an objection in or, you know,
what's
anything
the problem?
Like that. It's red tape in terms of like getting rights of way. It's all legal issues that should be fairly straightforward to overcome, but they're going to cost €20,000 in a year getting to the High Court, you know, to be able to get a legal right of way. At the moment, to get to that property, we need to fly a helicopter and we can land down on top of it. Now, it has no roof, so there's no helipad that's going to be put in on it, but we can't drive a car to it, you know. So, like, there's lots of legal hiccups and as I say, brick walls that we're months into this, and we don't want to invest money into it if it's not going to work out, but so yeah, and my story is replicated by, like, you know, thousands.
It's one snapshot of it. Oisin,
I mean, I think it's as Lorna says, it more affirms this emerging divide than discovers it. But what I was struck by in the analysis by John Rogers of Red Sea is that the combined total of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is now at 37%, whereas back in 2018, 2019, before they came together in government, it was at 58 or 55%. That is a 20% drop. And he's now saying the ceiling, the plateau is 43%. They haven't been over 43% together since 2021. We knew that trend was happening, but that's a really big change in only 5 or 6 years. And you would think, weirdly he says that still comfortably ahead of the others. But actually, if you add up Sinn Féin, Labour, Sock Dems and the Greens, you get to 35, which is more or less the same. And if you add in People Before Profit, who you may or may not join a centre-left government, would be 38. So actually, the combined opposition is now getting referred to a lot because of the speaking rights since then, is roughly the same.
Do you believe in the combined opposition, that they can stay combined, they could stay combined through a campaign, stay combined in a government?
I think that's the challenge for them. I think that's that seems now to be the lesson of the last election, was between dubious figures and dubious hopes of what might be changing in terms of housing and so on. It was one reason, but I think more fundamentally, people didn't see a simple alternative or like a clear alternative.
It's just interesting that Conall Thomas, writing about the poll, in his headline, he said the government parties will not be worried by the downward drift in the latest poll, probably for the very thing that you're talking about.
But Mary, hang on, no. There's a headline there. Conall Thomas writes, Fianna Fáil becalmed despite fall in support.
There's a suggestion
somewhere else about that the budget could affect the presidential election. If you're running as a Fianna Fáil candidate in the presidential election, let's not get back into that, but just make the point about what the context of it will be. The context of it will be that you would think that people are rapidly losing hope, and the numbers, they seem to have given up on the targets at this stage. They're going down and down. The ESRI are saying they're not going to happen. We haven't seen this putative new plan yet or anything. Is Fianna Fáil failing a generation here?
No, I don't believe they are, but I mean, they're certainly coming to grips with and taking realistic decisions in relation to things like housing. There's no point in setting out a big target if you're not going to reach it, because then people lose hope. There's no point in spending a million units.
But they have set out big targets that they're clearly, everyone else says they're not going to reach.
So they've now, but I think the government has also said not going to reach those targets, but going to address the infrastructure, going to address the planning problems, the finance is actually not the problem in this. But the...
I think we're told the finance is a problem, that we need money to build these houses, and that the private sector, this is a big part of
conversation. And we need to attract the developers. And I think what's interesting in the poll is the number of people who say that there should be tax incentives for developers. In other words, just solve the problem.
Okay.
But I mean, I was looking at...
Lorna, I'd like to bottle the look on your face now. Listen to Mary
Hannafin.
Could you use your words?
do you know, I agree that people are at the point of exhaustion and exasperation with this, and it's like, do anything to make it better, right? And that's a very simple, I think, short-term view of the issue, coming from somebody who's just explained the challenges I have in terms of trying to get a house, right? But as part of the greater good, I don't think that that is the reality. I don't think we should be offering tax incentives to developers in that way. I do think there was a Housing Commission report, and there is very strong recommendations in that in terms of how to try and address the housing challenges. And that is what I think government need to focus on implementing.
So I would also give the money back to the councils. Dunleary Right Down County Council has done a great job in actually building and developing. You probably know them yourself, Brendan. You'd have seen them around. Stopping the development of housing was disappointing for people, but not at €1 million a unit, when you can buy three houses for the same price in Finglas and East Wall, where those developments are actually going to take place. So a little bit of realism, I think, has come in now to the funding as well, and for developers to realise that.
Okay, just before we finish up on this, Scott, briefly, the front page of the Sunday Times: migrants face restrictions on social housing.
Where are you going to give them accommodation? Then the story we know is they have to have long-term ties to Ireland to now be on the social housing list. That doesn't deal with the issue of, if you say they don't have those ties, do you put them in tents? Do you try to stick them away and hide them? I don't want to be too cynical here, but it reads as a short-term thing to make the housing and the homeless list go down in terms of the numbers. And I'll just make a general point, having come from the UK, where the housing situation is not as serious as it is here, but it is a significant issue. And what happens is, rather than dealing with the housing issues, various folks find a punching bag to blame. Some of those people are very loud on social media, and others, with regret, are politicians.
Okay, but without using it as a punching bag, and Oisin, the Tánaiste himself has said this before, is it factually correct to say that a part of our homelessness numbers and problems, I think about maybe 28% of it, part of our problem in providing enough houses is inward immigration to Ireland, whether that be people coming in here on work permits or otherwise? Is it understandable, and I'll be very careful how I phrase this, but is it understandable? You do hear people use the phrase, if we can't get homes for our own, if we can't get a home for my daughter, why are we giving homes to people who choose to come and live in this country?
I think it's more complex than that, because I don't think any of the IPASS applicants are getting anywhere in the social housing list. They're not even being given tents a lot of the time now if you're a single man coming seeking asylum. And for example, there's a lot, I saw the number during the week, more than 1,000, maybe thousands of people who are in direct provision, who have obviously been on the country for a long time now, maybe working here, who've now got right, like they've been granted asylum, and they can't leave because there's nowhere for them to go. So they can't leave. They're still in direct provision because there's no housing. So I think this is more like,
and there are lots of people who can't leave their parents.
Well, exactly.
But I think this is
more
reasons.
Like vice signalling as opposed to virtue signalling. And I'm not sure this provision will make much difference, because I'm not sure who is it, like who, what, which migrants are you talking about that won't get this housing that are now getting it? I'm not convinced there are many of them, because you have to qualify in the first place. And do you mean the nurses from the Philippines or the teachers or whatever who come won't get in the housing? I think this is just like, we want to be seen to be tough rather than actually providing a solution.
Okay, have to take a break, guys. Scott Lucas, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hannafin and Oisin Coughlin staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us: Scott Lucas, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hannafin and Oisin Coughlin. Oisin, the Sunday Independent, their headline is "Kneecap Turn Air Blue at Glastonbury with Chance of Free Macara and F. Keir Starmer." This is getting kind of comical for the British establishment at this stage, isn't it?
I think it's the Barbra Streisand effect, isn't that what it's called? Where you draw more attention to your problems. I think it's what Keir Starmer is doing. First of all, I think the main thing to say is that there was a huge turnout for the kneecap.
They closed the West Hole access to the West Hole.
I think it was 20,000. There was no more space.
Yeah, I think it could be more than that.
And the Guardian gave it a 5-star review as a musical performance at a music festival. Of course, music and politics interact. And there was a lot of Palestinian flags and a lot of chants of Free Palestine. And yes, they took a few pot shots at Keir Starmer for his idiotic interventions, saying that music, you know, the musicians shouldn't be allowed to play at a music festival because he doesn't agree with their politics. And it's just like, I think, you know, it's a long way from where Jeremy Corbyn was being chanted positively at Glastonbury. And I don't, I mean, that's just politics too.
That was okay.
And he didn't get elected. So I can see why Keir Starmer wants to do something else. But I think it's just like, I really hope Keir Starmer doesn't actually believe musicians shouldn't be able to express their opinions. He's just afraid of voters for reform, choosing reform, and he wants to be seen to be tough on anything that looks liberal or woke. But I think it looks pitiful.
I suppose the line they crossed was the kind of expressing support for Hamas and Hezbollah and then saying, actually, we didn't mean that.
Previously, and let that go through the courts, although Sally Rooney had an article this week about, so you know, this is the crime that that Britain chooses to go after rather than the actual Israeli war crimes in the Middle East. This is what you want to clamp down on artists, you know, misspeaking or whatever. So I actually had that article in The Guardian this week. I think it is disproportionate and counterproductive for the British government to go after an Irish rap band from Belfast around how occupied territories should respond to occupiers.
So Brenda, can I just say, I just love what NECAP are doing for the Irish language and what they're doing with young people and the support they have, and their lyrics are so clever. I think if any government really understood what they were saying, it isn't the flags they'd be objecting to. Their rhyming is just spectacular. It really is.
And it's wonderful. And you have no issues around the politics.
They'll be at her first garden party in the Irish.
Come here, they should go back over. No, there'd be a lot of footage. They should go back over Glastonbury for the last 50 years or whatever, like, and start prosecuting people for everything everyone ever said. There was also, Lorna, it kind of slapped them in the face. Then the BBC chose not to transmit NECAP. They chose to transmit the band who were on before NECAP, Bob Villain, who were kind of punk rap, and they ended up saying much worse stuff.
Well, that's it. Like, NECAP seems to be the poster of the, you know, I suppose the campaign to call out what is happening and what the Israeli IDF are doing in Gaza, but they're not alone. You know what I mean? I think there are huge amounts of musicians and general population.
It's hardly
population.
A revolutionary stance in the culture in general, is
exactly.
it?
And like, I think the general, like the majority of people here, absolutely, and we know this, are in support of Gazans and trying to, you know, support, I suppose, NECAP in shining a light on something that I think we all feel a little bit helpless in, you know, at times in terms of what we can do. And I think NECAP are probably given us a little bit of hope in terms of being able to really draw attention to something and in a different way, grab a different audience, grab attention in different ways and so on. But as you say, if they looked back through 50 years of Glastonbury, you know, I don't think NECAP would be the only one that you'd be trying to...
They'd find worse now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Scott, tell us about the Democratic candidate for mayor of New York. Lurkin Nine is writing about it in the Sunday Independent. This is Zoran Mamdani.
Zoran Mamdani, who born in Uganda, of Indian descent, an Indian Muslim. Very few people had heard of him until a few weeks ago. He was one of the candidates against a man named Andrew Cuomo, who a lot of people have heard of because he was the former governor of New York. And in the last few weeks, you saw one of those grassroots movements where people began to be energized by a campaign, and Mamdani won. He will be the Democratic nominee in November, despite millions of dollars being poured into Cuomo's campaign, and millions will be poured into campaigns of other candidates who will run as independents, as well as the Republican.
Because apparently the burghers of New York City now, the rich burghers of New York City, are massing to pump money into another independent candidate, potentially Cuomo, to make sure this guy doesn't win.
Because he's daring to say that you should be putting public funds into things like affordable housing, putting funds in terms of a better education system, deal with health care. He openly identifies as a democratic socialist, and we know that socialist is a smear word for many Americans that take place.
Could this point to a way forward for the Democrats?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, it's interesting because in the immediate aftermath of this, there are a series of commentators in the United States and indeed here who identify as Democrats, who said, this is it. The Democrats are finished. They've chosen this extreme candidate. And that's because these are folks that pretty much think that there's really no hope for, as it were, for the progressive presentation of issues because America is too toxic as a political culture. I think what you have to emphasize about America is that America is not just a single nation. It's 50 different states. It's many cities, including New York. And that it's the grassroots politics that will make the change.
Yeah, I saw an interesting thesis that Mamdani understands the attention economy now in the way that Trump does, and Cuomo does not. He's of the old world, pumping millions into these ads and everything. Mamdani, a genius at TikTok, and understand that you earn attention. You can't buy attention.
And his
anymore.
Actual policies are pretty straightforward. They're not that radical. And I saw an article in the Financial Times yesterday saying there's common ground.
I want to get to Mary on the Jeff Bezos wedding, and we only have about a minute left. You have thoughts.
There's a lot of coverage of an obscene amount of money having been spent on a wedding. But the one that got me when I saw that she had 27 different outfits for 3 days, but then bucket of rain, and they had to end one of their celebrations at night at 11 o'clock, and I'll bet you she didn't have a raincoat.
Lots of lessons.
Or she didn't put out the child
Lots of lessons there for a person who's going to have a lot of events to do and garden parties and everything else in a potentially rainy country in the middle of the Phoenix Park, I think. Okay, thank you very much to my panel today. Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute, UCD. Lorna Fitzpatrick, Communications Consultant. Mary Hannafin, barrister and former Fianna Fáil Minister for Education, and Oisin Coughlan, public policy advisor. And it is just 12 noon now, and we will go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.